Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Frank Rogers. Today's session number is 98-5. Today's session is titled Spirituality and Story, Reconnecting to the Source. Let's listen in.
That's right. Vestiges from my Indiana college days, y'all. So thank you for coming this morning. And for our tape friends, we're ready to start. This is the first of three sessions this week on the topic spirituality and story. And today's subtitle is called Reconnecting with the Source. Parenthetically, I'm going to be doing a session tomorrow in the late afternoon on discernment, the practice of spiritual discernment, which is a chapter in the book that is the theme book for our work this summer. And that is a piece unto itself. The other two sections of this particular series will be Thursday and Friday. But they're not unrelated themes by any means, as we will explore. But today's is the first. And spirituality and story, where this comes out for me is I have been thinking about spirituality a great long time, as all of us have. And I think spirituality has something to do with nurturing those impulses that lie deep within us, those impulses of the human spirit that yearn for the fullness of life. And the fullness of life has many dimensions to it, that yearning for peace in the midst of a chaotic and busy world, that yearning for healing in the midst of our woundedness, the healing for hope in the midst of despair in our world, the healing for the fullness of personal power and communal collectivity. All of those yearnings that beat down in the pulse of the human soul, I think nurturing those is what spirituality is about. And I think that we as Christians, we recognize that we do not nurture those impulses by ourselves. But rather, there is a presence in our world. There is a reality that is the Spirit of God, who also yearns for the fullness of life, who yearns to be in relationship with us and is nurturing that same thing for which we long. And that Christian spirituality is, you might say, the wedding of those two spirits coming together, the harmony of the pulse beats of our spirit coming into tune with the pulse beat of God's spirit. And the wedding of those two spirits, the harmony, is what I like to play around with as spirituality. As a way of getting us started, anyway. But the other thing that I have a real conviction about is that I believe in the power of story. I think that story has a unique ability to access those currents of spirit, to put us in touch with our own longings and our own joys, and helps us to discern the movements of God's spirit in the world. And so I would like to play around together over the next several days about what is spirituality, what are some of the movements and currents of God's life in the spirit, and use story as a vehicle through which we might unpack a number of those dimensions, and hence spirituality and story. So get at least a frame of where we might be playing within. So why don't we begin with a story. When Justin, my son, was about 5 years old, we found ourselves navigating the twists and turns of life in a very small one-bedroom apartment. It was a cozy enough place. It was home, to be sure, but it was only one bedroom, and so we were sharing a room and sharing a small kitchen. But the big thing that was wonderful about it was that it was on the first floor, and it looked out a sliding glass door into this 6-foot mound of dirt in which everybody from all the kids in the neighborhood would collect themselves. And they would pan for gold, they would make fortresses, they would dig for dinosaur fossils. They had an absolute blast, and Justin loved being there. And we weren't really experiencing ourselves as being too cramped until some very good friends of mine, including my godson, a family of four from Seattle, moved to Southern California and was only 1 week away from closing their house. And so we asked them to move in with us. So we, the six of us, shared this one-bedroom apartment, and Justin was doing pretty well. I mean, he had the hardest, I think. He had to share his room, and we slept out in the living room, and he had to share all of his toys with the kids. He had to share his dad's attention, and he was doing pretty good as 1 week stretched into two, and two stretched into four, and four peaked into six. And by that point, I think Justin reached an end where he had just about had it. And it happened one day when the woman, a friend of mine, we were sitting in the living room listening to the radio, and Justin was out digging for dinosaur fossils with all of his friends, and my godson Jackson, who was Justin's age, was drawing in the living room, kneeling on the floor in the living room table there, and Justin had found, I think, the tailbone of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and he had his shovel, and he was just going at it with all get out, when what should happen but a neighbor boy with just absolute undaunted courage comes up and just grabs the shovel right out of Justin's hand and starts digging for gold or something. Well, Justin looks at him, thinking, excuse me, that's my shovel, reaches over and just grabs it right back out of his hand and starts digging some more. Well, this kid, nothing's stopping him. He goes back to Justin and pulls it again. Justin's hands are going with it, and he just gives a super yank, and the shovel comes out of Justin's hands, and he starts digging more. And Justin stops and looks at that kid with a look that would kill. And then he stomped the dirt, pounded his way down the mound, slammed open the sliding door, slammed it shut, stomped his way, and plopped right into his rocking chair in the corner of the living room, and just crossed his arms and pouted. I said, Justin, what's the matter? I'm mad, and I am not playing with my friends ever again in my entire life. Well, I've been there, and so I let him have his space, and my friend and I continued to talk, and Jackson continued to color on the living room table, and Justin continued to sat, and the radio continued to play, and after a couple of commercial breaks went by, a song came onto the radio, and it was Kenny G. Do y'all know Kenny G, the saxophonist, instrumental saxophonist? And just like the bells just kind of come into our room right now, that music just began to work its way into the living room. And it just began to swirl its way all around us, and its melody worked its way into us, and Jackson was the one who picked up on it. Coloring away, 5 years old, having a good time, but as the music comes, his shoulders start to bounce up and down, and his hands start to sway. And before you know it, he cannot help himself. And he lifts his head up, and he starts to grin from ear to ear, and he stands up, and he just starts to dance in the middle of the living room, swaying back and forth, having an absolute ball. And we're just talking, kind of seeing how cute he was, and Justin's in the corner, and Jackson looks over at Justin while he's dancing. He says, "Hey, Justin, do you want to dance with me?" Justin's looking at him. Well, what the heck, I guess. And he gets out of his rocking chair, and he moves over with Jackson. And by the time he gets into the middle of the living room, his shoulders are swaying too, and they grab hands. And before you know it, the two of them are swirling back and forth. They're giving each other twists and turns. As the music continues to play, it gets deeper inside of them. They start doing Travolta things. They do little line dances. Justin's mimicking Jackson. They get on the floor, and they kind of twirl around. They're having an absolute ball as this music just carries them into this realm of absolute delightfulness. And we are just laughing and giggling, seeing the radiance come out of the living room floor as the two of them are having the time of their lives. And the music, just as it came into the room, just as mysteriously, it swirled its way out, and the two of them looked at each other, and Jackson said, "You want to go out and dig for dinosaur bones?" And Justin said, "Yeah, let's go." And he started running out the door. And I said, "Wait a minute, Justin, where are you going?" "I'm going to play with my friends." I said, "Play with your friends? I thought you said you were never going to play with your friends ever again in your entire life." And he looked at me like, "What in the world are you talking about?" And then he remembered, like it was a lifetime ago. "That's right." And he says, "You know, I think the dancing took my mad away." The two of them rejoined the community and played. there is a music that plays its way through our world. There is a presence that has its own rhythm, and its rhythms sweep through creation. Its rhythms are woven into the very heart of creation. And that music is God's spirit, God's own yearnings to be in relationship, God's own yearnings reaching out a hand and inviting us to move to God's rhythms, to be in step with the movement of God's presence in our world, with the hope that as we take that hand, as we follow those steps, as we practice the movement of God's Spirit, we will find ourselves taken up into the dance. We will find ourselves dancing with God's Spirit. We will find God's own Spirit's rhythms mingling deep and becoming the rhythms of our own spirit. And that dance, that participation with God's Spirit, is a dance that heals. It's a dance that heals our wounds. It restores community. It emboldens us into our life. It gives us hope. It enables us to move into the world where there is pain with a greater sense of urgency and with acts of healing and compassion. Just as Justin was healed in the dance of Jackson, so too, as we participate in the dance of God's Spirit, we find ourselves being worked on and moving to a fundamentally different current that heals and restores and brings hope. I think spirituality is about listening for that music and seeking to respond to the ways in which we are invited to move to its rhythms and enter into that healing, hope-giving presence that is in our midst. What do you think? Does that make some sense? Would it be too much to close the door? Would that be all right? Let's try that. Oh, it's next door. It's the board. Somebody's got to talk to those boardrooms. Oh, okay. Well, whatever. That's right. Close the board.
Exactly. Shut them down.
Well, I mean, as an image, does that resonate with different?
And as the dance took away the madness, so forgiveness takes away our anger and our hurts and our and prayer as it cycles into that forgiveness. And we can't forgive on our own. It's God's forgiveness through us.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I sometimes play around. This isn't in the book, but the whole notion of practicing our faith and these 12 different practices that we are invited to participate in, I sometimes think of those as dance steps. That those are, they are patterns of action. They have movements to them and what things to do. And the peculiar promise of them, like forgiveness and like prayer, is that as we move to those steps, as we worship and we break bread together, we find ourselves, after a while, doing more than just moving to the steps. A spirit takes over. We get caught up into a life, and that life heals and brings hope and brings power and brings community, and transformation happens in the midst of that.
Well, given that, then I guess if you hang around outside very much or read the papers, it would seem that the dance and the music is pretty much stopped in our society today.
Yeah, our society, as we look, it seems filled with noise, doesn't it? Instead of dance and melody, we hear cacophony and alienation and interruption and busyness. And we have to look hard to find a different music, do we not? And that, I think, is the invitation of spirituality, is to say, no, I'm not going to live in those currents. I'm not going to move to that noise. I'm going to stop. I'm going to participate in communities that hear a different beat. And I'm going to try to connect with that source and try to participate in its music. And it's very different than the one that we hear in our society. In many ways, the violence and whatnot. Well, I think also, in the same way that spirituality is about listening to a music and being swept up and healed by its currents, I think that the practice of storytelling also has that power. That telling stories also has an ability to it to sort of wrap us up into the music, so to speak, to wrap us up into the dance in the same way that Justin was wrapped up into the dance. Saturday, Justin and I were hiking back from Heart Lake, and Justin was really tired, and I had to get back for a meeting, and I was trying to think, how in the world are we going to get back here on time? And so I just proceeded to tell a story, and I just was making it up on the spot about a snowflake up in the mountain that fell into the river and ended up going all the way out into the sea and then became a raindrop up in the clouds and made its way back. I've just kind of made it up as a little, and the trip was over like that. Justin, just let's keep walking, keep telling the story. Just kind of wrap this up in. I think story has an ability to wrap us into its life. And when we share stories of spirit, particular stories that access those yearnings and those glimpses of the music, that is a spiritual practice that helps us participate and to discern the movements of God's spirit, the movements of God's music in the world. Does that make sense? The story of Justin dancing. To illustrate a point, let me tell another story. The only reason I'm doing this session is I like to tell stories, and I needed an excuse. When I was in my fourth year of my PhD program in theology, I found myself in need of reconnecting with those life-giving springs of spirit that inspired me to go to seminary in the first place. This was 4 years of a PhD program that followed 3 years of an MDiv program that followed 4 years of a BA program that followed 12 years of public school. I think I figured out it was my 26th year of schooling, right, without a stop. And I was beginning to wonder, what am I doing here? But it was exasperated by the fact that I was preparing for my doctoral comprehensive exams. These were 5 days of 8-hour written exams that culminated in a 3-hour oral exam in front of all of my faculty at Princeton Seminary, where they were going to grill me on every detail of theology that is imaginable and see whether or not I would be invited to the table of the intellectually credentialed and feast in theological discussion and be able to enjoy that practice for the rest of my... I was scared to death. And I began to ask myself, why did I get on this road in the first place? What am I doing here? I need to find something to get me, reconnect me. Well, I lived out in the country, and every day, early in the morning, I would drive to the library and sit behind stacks of books and wait there late in the evening studying and then drive home. And I would always pass by this monastery that was on the very edge of town. Our Lady of Princeton, and I'm Roman Catholic, it's a Catholic monastery. And I hardly even noticed it at first as I was continuing to think about all these theological points, the differences between transubstantiation and Luther's real presence and the Eucharist, and working all of these details out. But by after a while, I began to realize that here was this beautiful place. And I began to wonder what was on the other side of its walls. And I began to want to participate in some kind of a practice that took me out of the theological jargon that I was involved in all the time. So I called them up and said if they had daily mass. And sure enough, they did. So early the next morning, I got in my car. And instead of driving to the library, I pulled off into Our Lady of Princeton. As soon as I drove under the arch, it was like I entered a different world. Silence just permeated this place. The silhouettes of the trees just reverberated with a presence that was almost palpable. I meandered down the road and pulled my car up against the only other car, 1962 Rambler, I think. Turned off my car, and I walked into this chapel. Huge door. And as I went in, the room was only lit by a couple of candles on the altar, some bread draped by a towel, the wine in a chalice already on the altar, already waiting for me. And as I entered into the sanctuary, I met for the first time Harry. Harry was an elderly gentleman, sitting in the same place that he always sat in every time I would come, about 3/4 of the way towards the back on the right-hand side. He wore a tweed jacket, a wrinkled white shirt. He had on a tie. He had an overcoat draped over his lap, and he had a hat put on top of it. But the most important thing about it was that his face was looking straight at me and smiling in this big grin. Like he was welcoming me to this feast. Like this place was a party, and it was all ready, and I was the guest of honor, and we couldn't start until I had arrived, and he, the host, was so glad I finally got there, because now we could begin, and he just smiled at me, and welcomed me, and watched me to my seat as I went and sat down, and I marveled at who is this incredibly interesting-looking gentleman. Well, I sat down. We celebrated Eucharist, and as I was walking my way out, I felt somebody grab onto my arm, and I thought I was helping him walk at the time, because there on my side was Harry. And as we started to walk out to our cars, we developed a practice that was our routine for all the months that followed. Every morning, I would stop at daily Eucharist on my way to the library. And after Eucharist, we would walk our way out together and sit in the parking lot for a couple of minutes and chat. And that's when I found out that his name was Harry, and that Harry was a retired telephone repair person. He had been retired for a number of years. He was a son of immigrant parents who didn't speak any English. He worked his way up through a telephone company and climbed telephone poles for 47 years. He was married, but had been a widower for about 15. They raised two kids who went to college. One became a prominent doctor in town. He lived in an apartment behind his back. And Harry was the most delightful person. I found out that Harry was friends with half of Princeton. He would wander around the barber shops and the parks and sit on benches and chat about news. But also, every day, after we finished Eucharist, Harry would go to an elderly home where the guests there would welcome and wait for him to come. And he would spend the morning playing chess and chatting about news stories and just bring cheer to these people. He was a lovely, lovely gentleman. And I also came to find out that Thanksgiving Day, he would bring his legendary 7-layered cake to the elderly home, and word had it, nobody baked a cake like Harry. Harry was just one of the most charming gentlemen I ever met. Well, I became curious. And once I began to wonder about something, it just gnawed at me until I couldn't help myself, and I had to ask. We walked out towards the cars one day, his 62 Rambler, and I finally said to Harry, I said, Harry, every day I come to Mass, no matter how early, no matter how late, no matter how hot, no matter how stormy, you are always, already here. You're always sitting in the same place. You always are turning and greeting every single person who comes in for Eucharist. You are so disciplined. There is obviously something about this that speaks greatly to you. What is it about Eucharist that is so important to you that you've made it such a central part of your life? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know. I guess it just feels right. And then, almost as if it were irrelevant, he said, did I ever tell you about my 30th wedding anniversary? My wife and I, we decided that we were going to do it upright. The kids were away at school, so it was just the two of us. So we went into our closets, we got the nicest clothes that we could possibly find, got all dressed up, got into the car, and we drove all the way to the shore, and we were going to look for the classiest restaurant that we could possibly find. No Denny's for us. We go to Denny's all the time. We were going to find something classy. And we found something that was even classier than we thought existed. We found a restaurant that was only open for one meal a day, dinner. Can you imagine? Denny's is open 24 hours a day. This place is only open for one meal. Well, we drove up into the parking lot, and we walked up to the restaurant, and we walk up and we say to this guy who's in a tuxedo of all things, we say, can we have dinner here? And he says, well, certainly you may have dinner, but you see, we don't open for about another 20 minutes. Can you come back then? 20 minutes? You're kidding me. Nope, we only open at 6 o'clock. And so he says, Harry, well, is there some place we can come in and have a drink? You see, it's our 30th wedding anniversary, and we'd like to celebrate. And just as he's saying that, the owner of the restaurant walks by and overhears 30th wedding anniversary. You two have been married 30 years? Yes. That's incredible. come on in. And the owner takes them into this restaurant, and he says, Frank, it was the most unbelievable thing you ever... I didn't know if it was a restaurant or a palace. They had ice sculptures, they had plants hanging down from everywhere, and the table settings. They had 5 different plates. A plate for dinner, a plate for salad, a plate for your bread, a plate for dessert. And the forks, they just went all the way down the end of the table. It was the most incredible thing. And this owner, he takes us to this big round table, right next to this huge window, looking out into the ocean. He says, the best table in the house, sit right down, I'll be right back. We didn't know what we should even touch, so we just sat in the chairs, and we waited till this guy came back. And he came back with that maitre d', and he had a bottle of champagne and 4 glasses, and as he's popping open the cork, he says, we're celebrating a toast to your 30th wedding anniversary. And he's still pouring the glasses when a waiter walks by and says, what's going on here? He says, hey, we're celebrating 30th wedding anniversary. They've been married 30 years. Get out of here. No, really, 30 years. Go get a glass and join us. As he's getting a glass, a waitress walks by. What's going on? We don't open for 15 minutes. 30 years anniversary they've been married. 30 years, get out of here. No, go get another glass and join us. While there, 2 more waiters come by. What's going on? Get out of here, get a couple more glasses. Before long, all the waiters and waitresses are around the table. Get another bottle of champagne, we're running out. They're making so much noise that people in the kitchen start to hear it. They open the door, the cook, what's going on out there? 30 years of, get out of here. Get another bottle of champagne and a couple more glasses. Bring everybody, in fact, get everybody. Get Danny and Susan, they're back in the dishwashing room. Get the whole crowd. And Harry says, before you know it, there were 20 or 30 people, the entire staff of this restaurant, standing around this table, each one with a glass of champagne in their hands, celebrating a toast to their 30 years of marriage. And he says, they were total strangers. They didn't even know our names. And as he's telling me this story, he's coming back to life, and I'm thinking, what an incredible story. And I say something really stupid, like, wow, Harry. Those are the kind of things that really warm your heart, aren't they? And he looks at me, 2 hands on his cane. Warm your heart? No. Those are the things that keep me alive. And we both just sat there, knowing that he had spoken something that was true. And after a few moments, he then said, tell me something. You're a seminary student. Do you think heaven's going to be like that? And this time I knew what to say. I said, oh yeah, Harry. I think heaven is going to be just like that. And he said, I hope so. I hope so. And he turned and got his 62 Rambler. And he drove down the lane to a group of persons where this time Harry was coming to those strangers, being the host and celebrating their lives. For 20 years, Harry held this story deep inside of him. And it was a story that worked on him. It was a story that spoke to him of God, of God's hopes. It's something that nurtured Harry's own hopes. This little glimpse of that day when there will be a feast and strangers will gather around the table, celebrating the wedding between God and God's world. And every once in a while, Harry would pull this jewel out and he would soak in its beauty and be touched by its hope. And it would energize him again. It would heal him some more. It would stir him a little bit more fully to be an agent of that hope, that presence, that inclusiveness as well. And every day he would go to Eucharist and celebrate that story again. For the Eucharist is that time when we remember that very same kind of a feast and where our hopes are rekindled. This story for Harry held the heartbeat of his own spiritual life. I think he was probably 100% accurate. It's what kept him alive, his spiritual life alive. Well, my hunch is that we all have stories that keep us alive. We all have stories that lay deep within us, that work on us, inside of us. And every once in a while, we bring them out. And we are healed in their beauty, and we are re-energized by them. And these stories, whether consciously or unconsciously, are re-energized and reconnected in liturgy and in worship and in prayer. These stories, I think, are a very central part of our own spiritual lives. Do we have stories like this? Well, I think that probably one of the practices of our faith is storytelling, remembering our stories, of soaking in their beauty, of being energized by their hopes. My hunch is that's one of the practices of spirituality. How are we doing?
Great.
Well, what do you think?
It's true.
Or what do you feel?
It's true. And hearing other people's stories and the encouragement that they give you, you know, and their people's stories walking with the Lord, and that encourages you.
That's right. And it's not just Harry that is encouraged and renewed by his story. That story renews and encourages me as I'm sitting there listening to it and reminds me of what I'm doing and puts me back in touch with that spring of life. And that story then is our story today. And every time it gets retold, it encourages us and it just sort of ripples and reverberates. And that story is now in all of us and it will work on us in strange and mysterious ways.
Yeah. I spent the last 9 months listening to stories. We were in Kazakhstan, and I worked with a German, border Germans who have gone through tremendous suffering. And just telling their stories, having somebody who knows how to listen with their heart. And it was such a blessing. And for them, I often thought it was like the children of Israel, remembering their story, because now they had hard times again. They had the most of their life. And they say, but the Lord helped me. For one thing, that I'm there, they say, the Lord sent to thank you. But also, like when they were in the labor camps, like the one woman would say, well, I asked God to give me just 200 grams of bread a day, and he did. And so they say it so to encourage themselves. What he did once for me, he can do now too in this situation. Or another said, I said, how did you know God was there with you? And she said, they had to work in the swamps and in the winter and with their feet frozen and everything. And she said, when I would embrace the trees, and ask for strength, I would get, or something like that. Everybody, it's just incredible. And I just want to affirm it, how important it is to allow people to tell their stories and to listen with your heart, not with your head, but with your heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a couple things that I take from those words. One is telling stories is very cathartic and healing, and so having the opportunity to share your pain and your joys is a very sacred practice, and how important it is for us all to receive and hear those stories. I like what you say, in your heart and not just in your head. But the other thing that I take that is implied in your words is that our stories also have a lot of pain in them. Mm-hmm. And they're not always happy stories. Sometimes they're very painful stories. And those stories are sacred too. And retrieving and accessing and sharing those stories and helping us heal those wounds and connecting with that pain and that suffering enables us to be compassionate and to be hope givers in the midst of this world as well. Yeah, I think that's...
It's kind of off the subject maybe, but I think we're very fortunate in liturgical churches to realize that every Sunday we tell the story again and we dramatize it. And our little congregation in Leavenworth is without a pastor right now, but we have three or four ordained people in the congregation who are presiding on Sunday morning. And one of the pastors always memorizes the gospel. He won't let us have the celebrate insert sheets. And he walks down the aisle, up and back and forth, and he just tells a story. And I know other pastors have done that, but this is the first time I've experienced that, and it's very impressive. And then the other thing I wanted to say was I just went to a worship workshop that Dan Erlander did for our congregation. And it never dawned on me that
story, somehow you make the, what you learn from it, you make it your own more, because if somebody just tells you the facts, they want to teach you these particular lessons, then they're telling you and you say, oh, uh-huh, okay. But if you tell a story, then I have to think about it and on my own come to these conclusions. And then
yeah.
They're more part of me.
That's right. You are more engaged as a story. You're inside it. You become a spec actor instead of just a spectator. And it also more and not just thinking, but you have to feel. I mean, you end up feeling for Harry, and what moved him, you're moved by also. And you know, I think the heart is the most important part of our spiritual lives, much more than the mind. You know, the mind makes a great servant, but it's a horrible master. Our heart needs to be that which drives us and impels us and moves us. And we need to speak from the heart and to the heart. Yeah. Two folks.
Oh, I just, in my life, I've had many mountaintop experiences where you really feel the spirit. And the older I get, you know, people need roses in December. All these experiences for me are getting closer and closer, like coming to Holden mm-hmm. and feeling the spirit, and they get closer and closer, and I just feel that one day all gonna be mm-hmm. and it's and when I go home and you know I just think about it and I'm just filled again, and I can go out and you know, it's just really great or something. And I think we need these roses in December to think about, and pretty soon here we are. They're all together and we're there.
They're all blooming. You know, December is filled with roses. Harry's little story. It's uh-huh. his rose in December, and uh-huh. in the midst of his sometimes loneliness and all of that, he pulls that out. And, yeah.
I have the privilege and usually the sobering responsibility of listening to stories of abuse in my practice mm-hmm. and medicine. I have patients with psychological trauma, PTSD, and the related disorders. And it's storytelling from patients who often have kept those experiences secret. And so in allowing those stories to be told, oftentimes for the first time, it's extremely therapeutic, spiritually, physically, psychologically. And so getting the stories to be told is a very, very therapeutic.
Absolutely.
And also very moving for me, and very instructive as well. I learned a tremendous amount of information from that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very cathartic and healing for the person who's telling it. I work with some kids in L.A. that that take it one step further, where they then create storytelling performances out of their own stories that they've, and to see the power as they bring meaning to them. It's really quite extraordinary. Very, very powerful.
And start reducing their Prozac doses right away.
Yeah, exactly.
Their depression starts
exactly. Jeff?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's right.
Sorry. That's right. I wanted to say so.
Recently, somebody said to me that in an oral culture, the story is the point. And in a literate culture, which most of us are in, a story is used to make a point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about that a lot, that I use the story and then I say, no, this is what this story should mean to you. And I ruin it in my preaching by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know that you ruin it, though, because I do think the story has its own life, and the story is going to, it's like yeast, is going to work its way into the people who hear it, and if they take different points, they're just going to check out when you're telling them the point and let their own points be made. But I think it's still, you know, my experience is that it still lives, I hope.
Listening to this gentleman reminds me of a wonderful book that's in the bookstore. I think it's Kitchen Table Wisdom.
Oh, uh-huh.
Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
It's a book of stories about pain and healing and
great
restoration.
Yeah. Well, we, I mean, stories, the other thing about stories that is bad is they start bringing up stories, too, and you start making your own connections and thinking about stories, and we could be here a long time just doing that, so. But I would like to shift one gear for our last few minutes, if that's okay. I'm not cutting off anybody. And that is that I think that these stories are very revealing about the life of spirit. We can dwell in them and gain tremendous insight about the longings of the human spirit, and about ways in which God moves in our world, and about what God is like, and what the hopes are that our God is inviting us to hope. I think these stories have great revelatory power to them as we allow them to work on us. And one of the things that I would like to suggest that's going to sort of frame the last 15 minutes today and the next several sessions is that as I play around with these stories, I discern several different movements of God's spirit in our world that I think these stories invite us to participate in. And if I were, I try to draw it on the board. But I kind of talk about God's spirit in our world as being like a current or like a heartbeat, really. And that heartbeat has a pulse to it, a rhythm to it. And that rhythm moves in three directions. Those of you who know about the active and contemplative rhythm of the spiritual life, you know, the contemplative being that time in which we connect with the source, and that active when we go out into the world. I think those are two rhythms of the spiritual life, but I've kind of added a third one, and we'll see if it flies. But I kind of see a third movement. The first movement of spirituality being that which settles us deeply, connecting with the source of God's care and God's womb-like love for creation. But a second movement of spirituality, I think, is spirituality also is about becoming emboldened or empowered in what it means to be a humanity fully alive, kind of stepping up with shoulders back and radiating in the glory of what it means to be fully alive. And if descending down into that connection with God's grace is like a down, emboldening as sort of an upward movement, as being lifted up like on the wings of eagles, and that rhythm of sinking down and being lifted up, I think, are two of the rhythms of spirituality. But a third one, I think, is that rhythm, that pulse of God's Spirit, also goes out into the world, that it stirs us to participate in the healing and transformation of the brokenness of the world, to participate in the coming of the kingdom of God. So that same Spirit that sinks us down and lifts us up also stirs us to participate in healing in the midst of the world. Sort of a threefold pulse of spirituality. And I use the metaphor of pulse quite intentionally. If you think of a heartbeat, the heart gathers at the center all of the broken and weary blood cells. And there it replenishes them, it re-nourishes them, re-energizes them, the second movement. And then it sends them back out into the body to gather the other broken, weary blood cells and to heal the wounds, only to come back to the center where they are gathered once more and replenished and sent back out. That sort of threefold gathering, centering, and being replenished and sent out into the world. world, I think, is a pulse of God's Spirit in the heart of our world. Does that make sense? Liturgy, I think, has the very same structure to it. In liturgy, we are gathered each Sunday around the center, the God who calls us to the very center. And there where we are nourished in word and sacrament, and then we are sent back out into the world to love and heal the world, only to gather once more. That's sort of that threefold pulse of spirituality. Is that as an image or a metaphor? Not a metaphor, but sort of an image that pulls together some different things. Well, the three sessions, originally there were four. This was the introduction, and we're going to spend one on each, but today we're blending the introduction with the first movement. And looking at what our stories have to open up for us about sinking down and connecting with the source of God's womb-like grace. And on Thursday, we'll share stories and talk about that dimension of spirituality in which we are emboldened into being a humanity fully alive and try to discern what are some of the ways in which God seeks to embolden us through the stories that we can share about that. And then on Friday, we'll share stories and ask questions about what can we learn about ways in which God's Spirit is inviting us to participate in the healing of the brokenness of creation through the stories about that that we know. That's kind of the method behind the madness. So, all right? So we've got 10 minutes, but maybe I just told a story or two to get us talking about those dimensions of God's Spirit that seeks to connect us with the source, God's womb-like grace, and heal us in the midst of that. What is that about? I was going to tell several more stories, so I'm just thinking about which one I'm going to tell now, since there's not enough time. So this one. Ready for another story? Is that all right?
Tell us that you went through your PhD at
Orwell. That's right. That's right. I did. I'm a tenured professor of all things. No, I mean, I'm one of those people that give oral exams.
I thought maybe you ought to have a conversion experience.
That's right. So, I think I'm going to tell a little different story just to kind of illuminate some things that we were talking about before. When I was in college, I was a religion major, and after 2 years of taking every Bible class, every theology class, every ministry class that I could cram into my schedule, I was ready to transform the world. I knew all my Bible. I knew what was wrong. I knew how to go about putting together Sunday school. I was itching to get out into the parish and heal the brokenness of the church and the whole bit. And I got my chance that summer after my junior year in college when I became a summer intern as one of the fulfillments for my major's requirement. And so for the entire summer, I was the associate pastor of a church in South San Francisco. And not only that, but my internship there gave the senior pastor the opportunity to take an extended vacation. So for 4 weeks, that entire church and every conceivable crisis you could imagine was in my hands. Well, one of those conceivable crises occurred on a Saturday morning. I was driving up the hill to the church, pulling into the parking lot. I was eager to get the worship bulletin finalized and Sunday school lessons for the next morning completed, when I found that there was somebody there already waiting for me. He was about an 11-year-old boy. He had long, frizzed-out hair, faded-out blue jeans with holes in the knees, an army trench coat, his hands were stuffed in the pockets, and he looked like he was very uncomfortable, like he was on holy ground and he didn't know what to do with that. And he was waiting for somebody to come. And before I even got the car turned off and could ease out of my door, he was already up along my side and he said, "Excuse me, but are you the pastor of this church?" And I said, "Well, I am the pastor of this church." And he says, "Oh, good. Will you come down and talk to my mom? My brother, he just killed himself last night, and she has no one to talk to." Several minutes later, I found myself pulling up in our car in front of this house all worn and beaten down. The paint was chipping off the walls. Grass had long since turned to dirt, strewn automobile parts all across the front. And I found myself walking into this living room, the drapes closed, completely darkened, where there was this woman, almost comatose, staring down the hallway into her bedroom, where just a few hours earlier, her 16-year-old boy had taken a handgun and shot himself. I stayed there for a couple of hours, and I don't have the slightest idea what I did. I don't remember talking, I don't remember listening, I just remember being there, and this woman trying to begin to make sense of this hole in her life. What I do remember is when I was leaving, and this boy, his name was Tony, asked if he could ride back up to the church with me. I said, sure. So he got into the front seat of my car and we drove back up to the parking lot. I invited him into the office. He said, no, he didn't want to go in there, but maybe we could just chat out in front of the car. And so we chatted for a while longer, sitting there on a foggy Saturday morning on the parking lot talking. And he began to tell me a little bit about what his life was like, about how his dad was this raging alcoholic who would come home drunk and beat up anything and anybody in his sight. How his mother was so depressed, she spent almost all of her time lying on her back in her darkened bedroom, unable to get up and do even the simple tasks of preparing a meal. She was so depressed. And the only person this boy had in the world who attended to him was his older brother, Danny. And Tony worshipped Danny. Tony tried to walk like Danny, he tried to talk like Danny, he dressed like Danny, he hung out with Danny's friends. He absolutely adored this guy, and this was the person who had just left his life. And as he began to describe what life was like, I began to get a sense of some of the pain that made Danny decide to find another place to rest. Well, after he shared all this stuff and we were talking, we reached a point where we were kind of silent. And then Tony said, I want to ask you something. Something really strange happened a few months ago. Dad came home and he was really ripped. So we got our coats and we knew we had to get the hell out of there. We went down to the corner liquor store, we got a couple of bottles of soda, and then we hung out in the elementary school. We were just leaning up against the handball courts there, and we were talking and trying to figure out when it would be safe for us to go back home. And I remember it was a beautiful night, the sky was clear, and there were all these stars. And while we were talking there, a star, a single star, shot across the sky. And on an impulse, the two of them began to wish upon this shooting star. And Danny the older would start out, and Tony the younger would follow. And Danny said, I wish I could play baseball like Willie Mays. I wish I could pitch like Juan Marichal. I wish I had a brand new car. I wish I had a brand new 10-speed bike. I wish Regina had the hots for me. I wish Susie would leave me alone. I wish Dad didn't drink so much. I wish Mom wasn't so sad. I wish Dad wasn't so mean. I wish Dad would stay away. I wish Mom didn't need me so much. I wish Mom cooked once in a while. I wish Dad were dead. I wish Mom would clean his clock. I wish that I was a long, long way away from here. And Tony didn't have an answer to that one, because Danny was a long, long way away. Then Danny snapped back and said, do you know what I wish, Tony? Do you know what I wish? I wish that I could fly. I wish that I had wings and I could fly right out of this earth. And what I wish is that if I could fly, I could fly right up into heaven and I could fly my way right in front of God. And what I really wish is that God would turn to me and I could see God's face and God would smile at me. And then he took his Coke bottle and he shattered it against a concrete wall and said, but the bastard would probably turn his back. And Tony looked at me and said, what I want to know, was he right? I mean, I know you can't, but if you could fly and see the face of God, would God smile at you? Or would God turn God's back? I think that deep in the soul of our own beings, we yearn to know the answer to that question. If you could wipe away all the busyness and all the things that we use to preoccupy ourselves, if you could get down to the very source of it all, is there a presence there? Is there a reality in our world that we can know, that we can relate to with some sense, that we could turn to Tony and Tanya and all the persons in our world and say, you know, I've only had but a glimpse of it myself, but I know, Tony, if God looked at you, God's face would break out in the greatest smile of delight. My hunch is that we all have our stories that give our answer to that question. Those places that we return to, those places that we sink down in, those places we reconnect with, where we brush close to the glimpses that we've had of God's presence in our lives. And out of that is the pulse beat of the lives in the spirit.